Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Donald Trump says the press corps are the enemy of the people. The press corps, in turn, say Donald Trump is very presidential. Where the people find themselves in this dance is unclear. We'll talk about what media really looking out for the public interest might look like with author and FAIR associate Norman Solomon, national coordinator of RootsAction.org and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Also on the show, it's been 1 year since the murder of Berta Cáceres. Court documents leaked to The Guardian support the idea that the killing of the Honduran environmental, indigenous rights, and feminist activist was planned by military intelligence specialists linked to Honduras' U.S.-trained special forces. Such extrajudicial killings in Honduras have spiked since the 2009 coup in which the United States played a key role, though that role is beyond obscured in media coverage that presents the U.S. as the solution to violence in that country. We'll talk about that with Beverly Bell of the group Other Worlds Are Possible. All of that's coming up, and we're going to get straight to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Sessions met with Russian envoy twice last year, encounters he later did not disclose. Was the Washington Post and other media's spin on what others didn't hesitate to call a lie? Attorney General Jeff Sessions' denial, under oath, of the kind of meetings he now acknowledges he had. That bit of damage control came off elite media's startlingly generous, you might say, reception to Donald Trump's speech to Congress, in which the New York Times actually credited him for, quote, following the written text on the teleprompters more closely than any major speech of his presidency, close quote. Trump advocated white nationalism with an indoor voice, and pundits loved it, was how Media Matters put it. Well, this was just as some were thinking that the U.S. press corps had accepted that their relationship with the Trump White House was going to be adversarial and were maybe even looking like taking a less complacent stand, at least saying that they would call lies lies. While corporate media try to sort out what they stand for, the question for us is, what do we need from journalism right now? What would truly independent media look like, and how could we use it to move forward? Norman Solomon is national coordinator of the online activist group RootsAction.org and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's also a longtime FAIR associate who joins us now by phone from the Bay Area. Welcome back to Counterspin, Norman Solomon.
Hey, thanks, Janine.
Well, I think elite media's treatment of Trump's speech to Congress, the centering of the performance of it rather than its content, the consecration with the term presidential, an utterly reflexive exercise in which media say that media see something a certain way. It was all a clear sign, if that were needed, that while they may do critical work, we can't rely on these media to hold our outrage and concern, to represent it, to represent us, you know. And I think some folks may have started to get a different idea about that for a minute. There's too much to say, of course, but I did want to start with that open question. What are some of the kinds of reporting that a vital democratic media would be doing in the face of a Trump administration?
Apparently, independence is really hard to maintain. And while the principle, the axiom of a free and independent press is something that journalists really embrace in theory, when it comes down to it, that sort of magnetic pull of power, whether out of the White House or, you know, Capitol Hill, it just seems often irresistible. And so there are so many euphemisms that kick in. And as you mentioned, Janine, the coverage of the Trump speech to the joint session of Congress just oozed praise for the high jump over very low standards of, you know, reading a teleprompter effectively and couching really pretty flagrant xenophobia and racism in more genteel terms.
We've seen just recently, you know, outlets taking umbrage at being excluded from press briefings, and that sort of looks like the Fourth Estate, you know, remembering what it's there for. But at the same time, you know, we've seen journalists arrested for reporting around DAPL, for example, and the elite media didn't come to their defense. And, you know, we see citizen journalists trying to document police abuse. It's a very, you know, cutting edge issue. And we don't see the sort of bastions of traditional media standing up for them. So it's almost like there's this press corps that we're meant to be defending, this First Amendment we're meant to be defending, but it's almost more theoretical than actual.
Well, there's so much of the press, the independent media, that are given short shrift or totally ignored by the dominant corporate media, which, contrary to myth, you know, largely by the numbers, dominate the internet and websites as well. I think that also is parallel to just the political scene. You know, we have this classic dynamic. It's been true for decades. FAIR has pointed it out repeatedly since founding in the mid-1980s, where when the Democratic and Republican Party leadership in Washington have a certain frame of reference, the dominant corporate media stay within it. And I think there's no clearer or more important example than the coverage of Russia and the whole uproar over Trump and Russian contacts and all the rest of it, where the mindset, the worldview of the people in Congress and the White House pretty much are the alpha and omega of where the mass media will go.
No one's saying perjury shouldn't be addressed, but it's so easy to lose sight of what this whole scandal about Russian involvement is grounded in. And it's as though Russia still is, for the media and for many people, a, pun intended, a red flag that kind of shuts down thinking and starts up this machinery of response, which looks very old.
Well, you know, it's new wine in old bottles. And really what is not talked about is so often profoundly in plain sight or should be in plain sight. For instance, it's very rare in all this just tsunami of coverage, this massive coverage, to see any mention of the fact that each country, Russia and the U.S., has several thousand nuclear weapons basically pointed at each other, 4,000 in each country under the military of each nation, mostly deployed or certainly at the ready to basically be able to incinerate not just the two countries, but billions of people on the planet with nuclear winter coming after. You know, neither party, major party, talked about that, rarely talked about in the news media. And then you get to, in all this coverage, with very rare exceptions, the nationalistic double standards, the failure to look at the agendas of outfits like the NSA and CIA to perpetuate and escalate hostility with Russia. We have the assumption that James Clapper, until very recently the director of national intelligence, is some sort of paragon of truthfulness when he was caught flagrantly lying to a Senate committee in early 2003 about surveillance, and we only know that with documented facts because the Snowden NSA revelations came 3 months later. You know, on and on, where basic independent journalism would ferret out and highlight these fundamental contradictions in the claims from people in power versus the realities.
And just in terms of, you know, at a time where we're hearing all these competing interpretations and where there's such a hunger to hear information that feeds a certain perspective, I would think minimally we would look to the media for certain standards of evidence, you know, so that when I see a news media article talking about, well, Trump praised Putin and wink, wink, you know, we know what that means. It just feels like such a throwback in terms of, you know, really separating fact from feeling and, you know, evidence from rumor. That's the baseline, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, that is a very McCarthyistic dynamic that the press and many Democrats on Capitol Hill have dragged us into, so that when a statement comes now from the Trump administration or perhaps a commentator on the margins to say that we need a modern equivalent of detente, that the U.S. and Russia have a joint stake in, for instance, not blowing up the planet and better relations and stepping away from the tripwire of nuclear confrontation, where actually, in fact, as the Union of Concerned Scientists points out, we have hair trigger alert nuclear missiles 10 minutes from launch on warning to be in the air. And yet there are aspersions cast, and you know, even a broken clock can be profoundly correct once in a while, aspersions cast on President Trump, for instance, at his news conference on February 16th. I mean, yeah, a lot of it was barely coherent, if that. But Trump said some things about relations with Russia that make absolute sense for the survival of the planet. And here are a couple of quick quotes. He said about Russia, "They're a very powerful nuclear country, and so are we. If we have a good relationship with Russia, believe me, that's a good thing, not a bad thing." And yet, to the extent those sorts of words from Trump are cited by U.S. journalists, it's almost invariably to supposedly corroborate that he's some kind of stool pigeon or flunky for the Kremlin. And, you know, by no means is this a right-wing meme particularly. As a matter of fact, it's most prevalent from outlets like MSNBC, from liberal commentators. For instance, the New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, 4 weeks after Trump became president, he wrote, and I'm quoting here from Krugman in his column in the New York Times, quote, "Nothing he has done since the inauguration allays fears that he is, in effect, a Putin puppet," unquote. And then the column ends with a matter-of-fact reference to the Trump-Putin axis. Well, if that's the attitude of so many commentators, especially liberal pro-Democratic Party commentators, that getting along with Russia and wanting to build bridges towards the Kremlin is some kind of danger to the Republic and perhaps treason, we are in a very dangerous situation.
I think what it underscores for me, Norman, is the importance of separating ideas from people, which is a very difficult thing, I think, for all of us, you know. But I just feel that if you find yourself nodding along to George W. Bush, you ought to know it's time for a paradigm shift, you know. We can say racism is bad, as George W. Bush said, you know, I don't like the racism. And we can also say that we don't really credit George W. Bush as the bringer of that message, you know.
Right.
And so what I'm trying to say is whoever is against Trump is good just doesn't seem like a winning idea. And what I'm looking for from the press, or what I would hope for, is this separation from ideas and their source. And you can support a good idea when a jerk says it, you know, and you can be against a bad idea even when the source is someone that you may have supported. I mean, that's what it's about, isn't it?
Yeah, rather than being knee-jerk and failing to be independent, what we need is really a willingness to report independently in terms of the press and to assess, analyze, and think independently. And it's very hard to do in the polarized environment where it's an either-or sort of binary, which side are you on? I think in a recent editorial, The Nation magazine made the point well when it said, just because Donald Trump is against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it doesn't mean that therefore, we should say, well, after all, we're for it.
Mm-hmm.
And the same would go for better relations with Russia. But so many of us, and it's really hard not to get in this mode, we are conditioned, certainly by the mass media, to choose up sides and to say that anything advocated by someone who we deplore must therefore be suspect or worse. And that's just a prescription for disaster in terms of political thought and for journalism.
We've been speaking with Norman Solomon from RootsAction.org. Thank you so much, Norman, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
March 2nd marks a year since the killing of Honduran indigenous rights and environmental activist Berta Cáceres. The private and state actors believed responsible for her murder never made any secret of the threat they saw from Cáceres and her group COPIN, the Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras. The threat to the ability of extractive industries to steal land and water out from under indigenous people with state sanction. Such predations and the accompanying violence have been exacerbated by the 2009 coup in Honduras, a coup that the U.S., critically, supported. If history is guide, what coverage you may see of the anniversary of Cáceres' death will acknowledge her as a human rights leader, but won't discuss U.S. complicity in her fate and that of many others killed, attacked, or jailed in Honduras for standing up for themselves and their communities. Beverly Bell is coordinator of the group Other Worlds Are Possible and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She worked and traveled with Berta Cáceres and COPIN for many years. Welcome back to Counterspin, Beverly Bell.
Thank you, Janine.
Well, in May of 2015, when we spoke to you last, corporate media in the U.S. were largely overlooking Berta Cáceres and COPIN being awarded the Goldman Environmental Prize, sort of Green Nobel. And we talked about that as a missed chance to bring to light connections between U.S.-based corporations and U.S. aid dollars and the violence against indigenous communities and environmental advocates, among others, in Honduras. I remember that at the time you said that because of her work, Berta's life hung by a thread. Well, that missed opportunity to talk became an ominous silence, it seems, just as it's been made painfully clear how important it is to make just those connections. I'd like to ask you to tell us about Honduras since the assassination and what still stands in the way of justice for Berta Cáceres and for all of those others.
The first thing that stands in the way of justice is that the Honduran government continues to be an imposed government and completely unaccountable. It reigns with full impunity, as have the administrations which preceded it ever since 2009, when, as you say, the U.S. very strongly backed a coup d'etat against Mel Zelaya, who was the last elected government of Honduras. Since then, there have been two other elections, and both have been total shams. They were certified by both the U.S. and Canada, but very few other governments. And so the government pretends to be a democracy and is certainly touted as such up here, but it is in fact a dictatorship and acts like one. The group Global Witness, very well known and well respected international human rights group, just put out another report saying that Honduras continues to be the most dangerous country in the world to be an environmental activist. And certainly the record of the last year proves that to be true. There have been dozens and dozens of assassination attempts, and at least six high-level indigenous activists, just indigenous activists, have been killed or were almost killed just in the past year since Berta Cáceres was killed. The most recent was on February 20th, when José de los Santos Sevilla, who was a leader of the Tolupan indigenous peoples, who are fighting their own battles against theft of their land and resource extraction, was killed. So he is only the last. I don't even have all the figures. They haven't even all been tracked. But what we know is that until there is a change in the actions of the Honduran government and a respect for lives, human rights, and democracy, that indigenous and other environmental actors will not be safe. And we know furthermore that there will not be this change vis-a-vis the Honduran government as long as the U.S. continues to send many, many, many millions of dollars of military aid to Honduras every year.
When Berta Cáceres was killed, the papers like the New York Times covered it, and they talked about how the coup, in fact, had made Honduras more dangerous for activists, but then they left out the U.S. role in the coup. Well, since then, U.S. media have gone, if you will, further. They've actually kind of worked to sell a whole different idea to U.S. citizens about the role that the U.S. has played and is playing in Honduras. What can you tell us about that?
Well, you mentioned the investigation into the events of March 2nd, a year ago, which is when Berta Cáceres was assassinated. Also that night, also in her house, a guest from Mexico, a very powerful indigenous and environmental defender on his own right, Gustavo Castro Soto, was shot and was almost killed. One bullet just missed his skull by a millimeter and took off part of his ear instead. He was also shot in the hand. He was then held illegally by the Honduran government and tortured for 1 month. And we do know, we actually have corroboration from State Department in a written email that they were part of that investigation. Gustavo escaped just by a hair with his life, and he and his family are now living in exile in Europe. So both Gustavo and the family of Berta Cáceres have been trying to have a fair investigation. This investigation, much like Berta's own killing, is really a window into the role of the United States government. And I'll just spin that out for you a little bit because it's part of the story that has been kept from the U.S. public, and certainly the Honduran public. So these two entities, one of them a direct survivor, Gustavo Castro Soto from Mexico. He's actually the director of Friends of the Earth Mexico in Chiapas. And then the family of Berta Cáceres have been trying to gather evidence. The Honduran government has blocked them at all turn, and then last September actually disappeared every shred of evidence that those two parties had spent 6 months collecting. Every document, every photograph, every scrap of paper that had the name of a lead, all disappeared. And, of course, the Honduran government said that it was a theft. Of course, we know that it wasn't. Furthermore, the Honduran government has refused to share any information with these players, including with Berta's very own daughters, and they have refused the offer of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to help out and to come in as a neutral player. That is not at all surprising. And then what the U.S. has done is only surprising in how far it goes. It's so egregious. What the U.S. did has been to arrest through a special unit that is deployed to the Honduran government. The U.S. has made arrests at strategic times of suspects and then has gone to the U.S. Congress, we know this for a fact, and said, oh, no, no, you can't cut off U.S. military aid to Honduras because then there will be no way to go forward with the investigation into Berta Cáceres' killing because the U.S. is the only team that is doing anything serious. The U.S. began doing this immediately after Keith Ellison introduced into Congress last year the Berta Cáceres Human Rights Act, which called on all U.S. military aid to be cut until there was significant improvement in human rights. And so it was immediately in response to this bill going into the U.S. Congress that we then saw the U.S. being so duplicitous and convincing Congress that U.S. aid had to continue flowing.
That would seem to dovetail nicely with the piece that some listeners may remember from August of last year in the New York Times, which was about how the U.S. is involved in Honduras and making things safer in Honduras. I mean, how the most dangerous place on earth got safer was the headline over this Week in Review piece. And the subhead I thought was very interesting. Programs funded by the United States are helping transform Honduras. Who says American power is dead? this seems to me to fit precisely with this effort to fight back against any plans to stop aid by saying, no, the U.S. is actually the force for justice here, including justice for Berta Cáceres.
Yes, that piece that you mentioned that came out last August is really extraordinary, and the same journalist did one the same week on national public radio. And both of them show one tiny little micro example of a little community where apparently, who knows if it's true, I doubt it, but where apparently U.S. government funding had helped one small community center. And through this, the journalist extrapolated and said that all of Honduras is getting better, as you say, Janine, thanks to U.S. funding. What's extra interesting about those two pieces is that they appeared just weeks after the president of Honduras, in response to the Berta Cáceres Human Rights Act moving forward in Congress, the president had come up to Washington to do a big PR blitz to ramp up the Honduran government's image using the convenient tool of U.S. media.
We've been speaking with Beverly Bell of the group Other Worlds. They're online at otherworldsarepossible.org. Thank you so much, Beverly Bell, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Janine, I'm delighted to speak with you, and I hope that all U.S. people listening will take responsibility for our government, such as it is, and get in touch with their congresspeople to push for this act that can truly make a difference for all Hondurans.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.